So anyway, a couple years later, let me just finish this. So Rod Meredith had to go back to Pasadena. He had no goods on me for anything. Okay. Then one summer, they sent out as a ministerial assistant, Carl Kellner. Anybody know Carl Kellner? He was out west and down south. Anyway, he was a gung-ho Marine jet pilot who was vain, arrogant, considered himself God's gift to humanity, especially the church, because there was no one like him. So they sent him out to be a ministerial assistant for me. Well, needless to say, he was very arrogant and presuming upon the brethren on everything. And so when I wrote up an evaluation, of course, that's a summary of many details. I could tell you half a dozen incidences with that. I put down there that Carl Kellner has a lot of ability, but until he gets rid of his vanity and arrogance and presuming upon the brethren, that he should never be ordained as a minister. Well, Pasadena had slotted him to be ordained to be a minister. Of course, I didn't know that. Okay. So, the next spring when he graduates, Richard Plache says, "Carl, come here, I want you to read something." So he hands him that evaluation. So there's my enemy number one. Okay? Of course, I didn't know this till years later. So then I get a call from David John Hill, and he says there's a man who has been disfellowshipped in the church in Phoenix, and he's moved up to Boise, and he's threatening to sue the church for $50,000. I want you to straighten this out. I'm going to send you all the information. Now, be careful. This man is a notorious liar. Okay. So I got the file. I just put it on my desk, did nothing with it. And so the man whose name was Brent Nolan called John Hill, because I hadn't contacted him, and said, "Well, I haven't heard from the minister yet." So he gave my number, so he called me. So he says, "I'm Brent Nolan, and I understand you're to help solve the problem on my disfellowshipment case." I said, "Yeah, I was hoping to avoid it. You know, I was hoping just not have to go through it." So I said, "Well," he said, "let's get together." And I said, "Well, the only time I can get together is after the Day of Atonement." And at that time, we had Rand Millich up there as a local elder who was assisting me in Boise. Said, "Well, we'll meet at his house." So I had all of this in mind, that he was disfellowshipped, accused of adultery, he defrauded a widow, notorious liar. Watch out for everything that he has to say, because nothing can possibly be true. Okay, so we get over there to Rand Millich's place, and we sit down, and he's telling me these horror stories. What happened? That the minister went around to his business contacts, ruined his business, went to the phone company, destroyed his credit. And I'm sitting there, this is unreal. How am I going to know this guy's telling the truth? So I just sit there and listen. And he said, "And I've had bleeding bowels over it." Ding, the light went on. If a man is a notorious, hard-hearted liar, he surely would not have bleeding bowels, would he? Okay? So I was praying. I said, "Oh, God, help me to understand. Help me, you know." So the idea came to me, this is Day of Atonement. So I looked him right in the eye and I said, "Today's Day of Atonement. Are you fasting?" He says, "Of course." I said, "Well, do you keep the Sabbath?" He says, "Yes, every week at home." I said to myself, based on that, I'm going to look at this thing thoroughly. So I says, "You have my word. Soon as the feast over, I'll come back and look into it." Well, the long and short of it was, he did not commit adultery with a woman, but it was on the word of one person who saw him go into a house of a woman alone to give an estimate for a remodel job. Okay? And that he put an addition on a widow's home in Phoenix, made of adobe brick, according to the plans she approved, And he gave all of his labor and a good portion of the material free. And he put it on according to the plans, and she came out there. Now, mind you, with adobe brick. She says, I want the windows moved from this wall over to this wall. And he said, I can't do that. He said, do you realize that I have to tear it down to the level of the sill and rebuild the whole thing and destroy half of the adobe brick to do it for you? And I've already done it where I can't afford to do it. So he walked off and left it. So therefore, Ron Reedy, the destroyer of brethren, he destroyed him, said, well, he's defrauded a widow, he's committed adultery with a woman, it was sent into Pasadena, guess who was the district superintendent? Al Carozzo. He took it up to Rod Meredith, guess who upheld it? Rod Meredith. Came down when Vernon Hargrove was sent over there for the second tour and went on up, came down with the second result, they upheld it three times. So here I've got this package now. So here I'm going through it. So I talked to Ron Reedy, and I talked to Vernon Hargrove, and I talked to different people, and I said, well, now how am I going to get my way through this thing? So I decided, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call a local contractor. Had the dimensions of the addition he was going to do and, you know, the materials and so forth. So I said, no. I said, I want you to give me the lowest possible price of an adobe addition this big and tell me what it would cost a square foot to do. He said, $17 a square foot. Okay, I said, do you think that a man who did it for $5 a square foot was defrauding a woman? And I explained about removing the windows and everything. He said, no. I said, would you redo the windows? He said, no. Especially if she refused to pay for it. He would not do it. Would you walk off and leave it? Absolutely. So I said, okay, he didn't sin against her. He didn't defraud her. She sinned against him by changing the plans. See? So I took that, put it over here. Then I decided, well, here are all of these nice letters from deacons and local elders, you know, the obedient sycophant spies. Well, we had Brent Noller and his wife over for dinner, and it was rather cold and stiff. Well, Brent was no idiot. He knew what was going on. See? So I had to say, okay, everything that's a sin against God, I'm going to put over here. Everything that's not a sin against God, I'm going to put over here. And I read through all of that, and it was really eye-opening. All the stuff, all the false accusations, all the way that they railroaded this guy, you know, to use the hierarchy to uphold a disfellowship, but I ended up with nothing over here against God and everything over here that was foolishness and not a sin. So I got done with that, and I called John Hill, and I said, I've solved the problem. Said he hasn't sinned against God. He says, well, good, call Brett, reinstate him, have him come to church. Okay. So I write up the report and send it in, and guess whose hands it goes to? Al Carozzo and Rod Meredith. How dare he go against the authority, see? Well, I didn't know that. Al Carozzo came out for a visit for Pentecost, and he really kept his cool. I mean, he was slick. He said, Fred, we have a nice big promotion for you. You've been out here for 7 years now. We have two big churches down in the headquarters area we'd like you to pastor, Torrance and Santa Monica. Okay. Well, what could I say? You know. And I was literally a lamb led to the slaughter, believe me. So we get on down there. Guess who the replacement minister is by design? Carl Kellner. With orders to find out everything about Fred Coulter, every dirty little thing he could dig up. And he couldn't. So he wrote up reports that I run everything by politics and I'm not a politician. My wife was a dirty housekeeper because there were rings in the toilet with Salt Lake City water hardness of 0.55. It was all contrived. But meanwhile, I get on down to Pasadena, and lo and behold, I have an eye-opening experience. I find that Al Portun is in this corner of the fourth floor. Rod Meredith is in this corner of the fourth floor. Garner Ted Armstrong is in this corner of the fourth floor. And Herbert Armstrong is this corner of the fourth floor. And Stan Rader is here. And all the different lieutenants with their various allegiance are all in between. And I found out that Rod hated Ted and Ted hated Rod, and they were contrary one to another, couldn't stand each other. That Al Portun had his own agenda, Rader had his own agenda, and poor Herbert Armstrong was all stuck off over here in the side. And here at God's headquarters, where you'd think love and truth would reign, we had carnality and hatred and politics and intrigue. See. Well, I got my dose of it. Al Carozzo, he had a meeting every week. All the sycophants come up and sit around. I remember one man, Ben Chapman, very well. He would sit at the right hand of Al Carozzo, and he was just like the yes man of the mafia. And he would always ask those leading questions for brownie points. You know, I call them brownie point questions. So here, I'm always sitting down here clear at the other end because I don't want any part of it, see. Which makes them believe that I'm as bad as they really think I am because I'm not participating in this stuff because I think it's stupidness and you don't need it. What do you need a meeting every week for except to come around and polish the shoes of Al Carozzo? See? And I wouldn't do that. Nor the other infamous things that, you know, you can say in slang about it. So little did I realize that they were working this case up against me in Salt Lake City. And when I came down to Torrance and Santa Monica, we'd have a combined Bible study at the Los Angeles Civic Center, and I was giving the series The Last 10 Days of Christ's Life. And Dave Brady, who was a printer, came up to me and said, "You gotta write a book. You gotta write a book." I said, "Oh no, I can't write a book on that." He says, "Yeah." I said, "No." I said, "Mr. Meredith has taught the class for 20 years on, you know, the first-year Bible, the Gospels." I said, "He ought to write it, not me." And then I'd come down a couple weeks, give another Bible study. He's like, "You've got to write a book. You've got to write a book on it." No. So then one day I'm in there gassing up my car at transportation. Many of you remember transportation, so I'm in there gassing up. And guess who comes in to gas up his car? Carl Kellner. And I have to add one thing here, too. After we came down to Pasadena, we took a vacation. This was in the first year when Carl first got up there. And I asked Al Carozzo if I could go up there and keep Pentecost, and he said yes. Later, he denied it and said no. So he accused me of being rebellious. But when I got up to Salt Lake City, and they had combined services in Ogden, where Pocatello came down and combined with Salt Lake City. Boy, when I was there, all the brethren came to me, told me what a terrible thing that was happening with Carl Kellner and how he just, you know, rode roughshod on them, come in and presume things, just to show you what happened. I ran both areas, Boise and Salt Lake. When I left, they gave him just Salt Lake, okay? And they gave Terry Swaggerty Boise. I ran that whole thing on $395 expenses a month. Within 4 months after I was there, Carl Kellner had it up to $895 just in Salt Lake City. And that shows you the presumptuousness that he had toward everything. Well, anyway, I'm there with the brethren, visiting with the brethren, and lo and behold, they have a stage where we're meeting, and Carl Kellner has the table set up where he has the local elders up there, and he has the main deacons up there, and he says, "Fred, come on up here and eat." He asked me 3 times to do it. I refused to do it. I stayed down there and talked with the brethren. I said, "You know, okay, I'll be up later." That became a great sin. So anyway, Here I am down at transportation, gassing up my car, and here comes in Carl Keller. I said, "Oh, Carl, what are you doing here?" He says, "Oh, haven't you heard of the meeting?" And I said, "What meeting?" And he just let it go at that. So I beat a path home. I told Dolores. And lo and behold, the phone rings. Okay, now this is on a Friday. Okay. And it's Al Caruso. And he says, "I have a meeting up here and I want you to come up." I said, "I'm not coming up unless Dolores comes with me." So we both went up there and we got ranted and raved at and berated for everything under the sun. And especially about that Brett Nolan thing. And especially about that paper that I wrote. And they just excoriated us and, you know, we left just shaking, trembling, and in fear. And then the next Friday, he called me up to his office again. And he said, "Fred Kolder, you're living your life dangerously and your ministry is in danger and, you know, you're in deep trouble." So I walked home. We lived down in South Pasadena. And I got home and I was just ghost white. Ash and gray and ghost white, if you could be the same time. So I walk in the house and Dolores says, "What's the matter?" So I told her. So I immediately began to fast and pray and called all my friends and said, "Fast and pray." You know, because I could see it was a terrible thing. They were coming to on pretense to get me out of the ministry, see. Okay. So Al Caruso said, after all those things, he said, "I can't discuss it with you now because I have to play racquetball." So that's when I walked home. Okay. "I will call you Sunday," because this was on Friday. Okay. So we fast and pray Sabbath. "Oh, God, what is it? What is it? What's going on?" You know, he didn't call Sunday. He didn't call Sunday night. Didn't call Monday morning. And I'm in the office, little office had at home praying, "Oh, God, help me understand. Help me understand. What have I done? If I've done anything wrong, help me to know so I can repent and change. Please let me know what this is." And just like a voice came to me, "Brett Nolan." And I said, "That's it!" Because I reinstated a man who should never have been disfellowshipped. So I came in and told Dolores. And so he didn't call all day Monday. Well, we quit fasting after we got the answer. Okay. He didn't call Tuesday morning. Late Tuesday afternoon, he called and he said, "Fred, I want you and Dolores to meet me down at the Carriage Inn." That's on California and Fair Oaks. So we get in there, and of course we're all nervous, you know. That kind of intimidation is to put you in fear and intimidation. So then he drove the nail home when we sat down to eat. And he said, "Fred Kolder, I want to tell you one thing." He says, "Dr. Zimmerman told me this one time, and I'm telling you the same thing. That what I have to say to you may not be right. But you better not open your mouth in one word." So I said to myself, I ain't saying nothing. So he ranted and raved about all these things, but there was nothing that they could do to get me out of the ministry. So guess what happened? Now, I'm sure not because of this, but because of many other things leading up to it. This was on Tuesday. Wednesday or Thursday, not Wednesday, but 2 days later on Thursday, Al Caruso resigned and went with Ernest Martin. Friday, Rod Meredith was fired. So there's an example of how God will deliver you. See, that Sabbath, I saw Dave Brady, and I said, "I'm writing the book." That was my sanity project when everything was going wrong in Pasadena. Remember this, whenever anything goes wrong, get your mind on Christ. Okay? They tried 4 times to kill the book. And Dave Brady was so excited about it that he got me on KABC Religion on the Line. Now, that was from 9 to 12, call-in show. Yeah, but you have a Catholic priest, Protestant minister, who was I was for 4 weeks in a row, and a Jewish rabbi. And so over a course, it didn't take long. Everybody was calling and asking me questions because I brought my Bible and sat down and opened it. See? And Ted Armstrong was just nervous. He had the radio department monitor that and tape that if Fred Coulter said one word out of line, he was going to be summarily fired. And I didn't know that till later. See? So here I am on KABC Religion on the Line. That presumptuous Fred Coulter. How dare he go on radio without permission? See? You know, that's the way the hierarchy views it, see. Okay, it's like dealing with the hierarchy of the civil government, you know, So anyway, it turned out great. It was marvelous. It was quite an experience. And I remember someone called up about the 3 days and 3 nights, and I'd just done that for the Harmony, so I was able to just poo right out 3 days and 3 nights. And a Jewish woman called up, and she talked to the rabbi, and it was Rabbi Franklin. I always kid Carl about that because his name is Franklin. And she says, Rabbi Franklin, my 19-year-old grandson was killed in a car wreck, and he was studying to be a doctor, and he was the finest boy. Why did God allow it? Take away my grandson. So he got done and says, now we all have to suffer. You know, the typical Jewish thing, see. So I said, well, would you mind if I answered something else for her? I said, no. I said, now, even in your scriptures, in Ezekiel 37, I want to tell you that God says that your grandson is going to be resurrected, that you will see him, you will hold him, you will love him, you will kiss him, and God will restore him to you and undo the evil of that tragedy. And she says, Rabbi Franklin, is that right? Hey, what can you do? It's in Ezekiel. Hey. So anyway, how much time do we have? What time is it? I don't even know. So when I was transferred up to... After I finished in Pasadena, I'll just jump ahead. And after the Harmony was done and I was up in Monterey, I thought, well, I have an idea for a radio program. So I walked into a radio station there in Monterey and said, I've got an idea for a radio program, call-in program titled Bible Answers to Your Questions. So I showed the man the Harmony and so forth, and he says, can you start Sunday? This was like on Thursday. I thought, oh, man. So what I did, I cleared it with Norman Smith, who was the regional director, and he says, sure, go ahead. So I had a talk radio program for 2.5 years up in Monterey that I did every Sunday night. So anyway, back to Pasadena. And back to the inner wars of the hierarchy. Well, let's see. That was after Ted Armstrong had been put out and reinstated for his philandering and so forth. So that was all going on. And, you know, Herbert Armstrong, I remember when he reinstated Ted, that the whole thing was just a big sham. And that with what Ted had done, that, you know, if anybody disqualified himself from the ministry, surely he had, you know. And, of course, there was the standard for for the peons and the more equal standard for the mucky bucks. And, of course, they didn't have to suffer from things. But just another little aside, when we first came down from Salt Lake to Pasadena, Bill Evans was in charge of the furnishings for the ministers, and they had certain houses that they were renting out and so forth from the highway department, where they had a planned freeway. They already had condemned and bought up the houses, but then it was stopped by lawsuits, so they would rent them out. So we moved into 1949 South Pasadena Avenue in Pasadena. And he was in charge of the furnishings and furniture, and so he was giving me a tour of some of the evangelist homes. So he brought me into Al Portun's home, which they were refurnishing, and he says, "See these drapes? Yeah, $40,000 out of third tithe." I didn't say a word, but I made up my mind right there, because they gave all the local pastors, ministers, they gave them a checkbook to help the needy. Well, I was in Torrance. We had the whole Watts area, so we had plenty of needy. So I made up my mind, every dollar I write, they cannot spend. So I was very generous in helping those that had need. And after I decided to do the book, I spent the time, and it took me a year and a half to do it, a paraphrased translation of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which was in the first and second edition. And during that time, there were four attempts to kill the book. And the first one was by Gunnar Freiberg's. And he couldn't find any good reason why I couldn't do it. The second one was by Lester Grabe, and he had me up in his office, and we were about 9 months away, and I just finished the paraphrase translation at that time. And he says, "Well, who do you think you are, Fred Coulter, writing this book? You're not a scholar." And I said, "Well, you know what Mr. Armstrong thinks about scholars, don't you?" I said, "I tell you what, I'll make you a deal." I said, "It's going to be published in about 9 months, and I will give you the whole paraphrase translation I have." So I did. Paid $120 to copy all the pages and give it to him. Never heard back from him, but I gave it to him. And I said, "If there's anything in there that's doctrinally incorrect, let me know, and I'll be happy to change it." So then, the third time they tried to kill it. The fourth time was really not trying to kill it, but it was an acquiescence to it. After Rod Meredith was fired, David Antin was put in as superintendent of the ministry. And his assistant was Les Stocker. Now, Les was really a fine, fine man. I really liked him. But Ted Armstrong told David Antion to kill the book that Fred Coulter was doing. So Les got the job. So he took me out to dinner at the Pepper Mill. Since he lived one place, I lived another, we met at the parking lot in the Hall of Administration. So we went out to dinner, had our niceties and our chat and everything, and came back, and we're standing there in the parking lot, and he says, "Ted Armstrong doesn't want you to do the book." And I said, "I have a message for Ted Armstrong. I am not sinning against God. I am not violating any contract, because I have signed no contract with the church. It is going to be doctrinally correct. And by this time, I'm shouting." Okay? Because of all the things I went through. And I said, "And I have a message for Ted Armstrong." I said, "You tell him that it's going to be published, and when it is, if I am disfellowshipped, that he's going to have a hard time explaining to the brethren why I was disfellowshipped for writing a book that is true." Turned around and walked away. And I was very sorry that that happened, because Les was really a nice man. Only problem is, he was doing his political duty. Well, just before it was published, and I borrowed $22,000 on my own to do it. Okay? We had a small ministerial conference, and David Antion was there. And in a break, I was out leaning up, against the door. Of course, only one or two ministers would talk to me because I was non persona non grata, in the hierarchy of the political accepted. And he sidled up to me and he says, "Fred," he says, "you going to publish the book?" I says, "You bet." He says, "When is it coming out?" I says, "It's going to be about 2 months." And he says, "We have one request." I said, "What's that?" "Do not mention Worldwide Church of God or Ambassador College." And I said, "You got a deal." So that's why in the dust jacket there's nothing about the church or Ambassador College. Okay. So published the book. Had 10,000 published. Very interesting. Now, we had a small house. Now, 10,000 books on pallets delivered by a freight truck, a long one, requires a lot of room. So I was down talking to John Egbert, who was in charge of the press at that time, and I was telling him about it. And he says, "Fred, come here." Because I used to work in supplies, where they have the steel stanchions, where they have the shelves, and you can put pallets on there. He says, "I'll tell you what." He says, "See that row on top up there?" I said, "Yeah." "It's empty, isn't it?" He says, "You have the truck when they deliver, come here at 4:45, and I will get the forklift man, and we will put them up there." So sure enough, right under their nose, there they sat. Okay. And when they came in, I opened up one pallet and took down some boxes of books, and I autographed them and gave them to everybody in the press. And they were all happy with them, thrilled to death with them. And then I didn't want to charge the brethren a lot for it. It cost me something like $2. It took the whole $22,000 to do it, so just say $2.22 a book. It was done by R.R. Donnelly in Crawfordsville, Indiana, where they make encyclopedias and everything. And by the way, during that time, I also helped Bill Dankenbrink start his Triumph Publishing. And he asked me how to do it, who to contact, and that's how he got the book on the 10 Laws of Radiant Health. Okay. So anyway, then at a Bible study one night, someone said, "Well, why don't we use Fred Coulter's Harmony in First Year Bible?" You send up the question, he read it out, and said, "Well, Fred Coulter's not a scholar." And boy, he stirred up a hornet's nest with that. Boy, did he ever. So anyway, to make a long story short, there was a battle back and forth, and finally they acquiesced to sell it in the college bookstore. Okay? "Well, why couldn't you sell it?" "Well, you sell other books by other people. You don't approve what they, Okay. Finally got it in. Then, I think it was before I got it into the bookstore, I decided to give an autographed copy to Ted Armstrong. So he had an assembly with the students there, and I knew he was in there, and I knew he would come across from the auditorium over to the Hall of Administration, so I was waiting on the steps. When I saw that he was coming out the door, I went back on the inside door of the Hall of Administration, and I just waited for him. Had a book in hand already autographed. Okay? So when he came in, I said, "Hi, Mr. Armstrong." Reached out and shook his hand. And I said, "Here's an autographed copy of my book." And he said, "Thank you," very nervously, and went on his way. Well, needless to say, who was the next one to write a book? Ted Armstrong, the book called what? The Real Jesus, written by Robert Kuhn. Ted Armstrong. Okay? So then, Helen Stiles, who was Mr. Armstrong's secretary at the time, she got a book. She called me and said, "You need to come and give a book to Mr. Armstrong." Well, I'd already talked to him several times over, and he knew me and so forth. And so she said, bring an autographed copy. So what I did, I went to a photographer, and I had the etchings enlarged and on white photographic paper and had them framed with the thin black frames with a nice glass front on them and so forth. And I took those up with me. And so the time for the appointment came. Mrs. Stiles let me in. There was Herbert Armstrong, very friendly, very friendly. We sat and talked, reminisced a little bit about old times. And I showed him the book, autographed it, gave it to him, and he said, oh, this is wonderful. This is nice. And then talked a little bit about that. And then I brought up one of the pictures that I had, and I said, Mr. Armstrong, here's a personal gift for you. And these were the etchings of the temple. And he came unglued with excitement. He was so happy to get those. And he said, picked up the phone, and he said, Mrs. Stiles, get in here right away. Bang! So she comes in. And says, I want you to call Bob Smith, the interior decorator, and I want these hung in the auditorium. So there are the four etchings that very day were hung in the auditorium down in the little alcove between the two classrooms on the lower floor. And I bet they're still there to this day. Okay? And I felt very much like Mordecai. And when I left, I gave Mr. Armstrong a handshake. He gave me a big hug, and I hugged him, shook my hand again, and he said, you know, I wish more ministers would write books. Thank you, God. Okay. So then, we had a ministerial conference, and this was in 1974. And there was a lot of trouble in the church at that time. And the black ministers were all up in arms. And at that conference, they promised the black ministers that they would have a conference on black issues. One of the sessions would be on that. And in my congregation in Torrance, we had 40% were black and 30% were black up in Santa Monica. 30% were Hispanic and 40% were white. And we had no race problems where I was, because I don't think in racial terms. I think in terms of helping people who are in need, teach them what they need to know, give them advice that they need, because they're human beings like anybody else and everybody needs help. They failed. They failed to put it on the agenda. And that was because David Antion was relieved of being superintendent of ministers, and Wayne Cole was put in. So they hastily set one up, extended the ministerial conference a day. And boy, I tell you, when we walked in there, it was like walking into an NAACP meeting with George Bush doing the talking. Hostility, you couldn't believe it. And I sat there, oh God, this is bad. I didn't know that they had all these feelings and hatred and just, I mean, it was spewing over like I have never heard before. So I said, oh God, deliver me out of this. How can I be delivered out of this mess? So it came to me while I was sitting there listening, and I came up to Wayne Cole afterwards, and I didn't let him know a thing, but I just said, you know, Mr. Cole, I've been here now 4 years. And I said, it'd be nice to kind of share the smog with someone else. And if it would be possible, I would really like to come in for a sabbatical. And it wouldn't cost you anything because I live here right now. You wouldn't have to move me or anything. So he says, I'll call you in a couple of days. So he called and said, yes, you can go on a sabbatical. So went on a sabbatical. And David Antion was teaching the classes, and Dr. Martin was teaching classes, and Art McCurr was teaching classes. And that's when I had Dr. Dorothy start a Greek class, and I paid for it, guaranteed it. We started out with 10. In 8 weeks, we were down to 3, and in 10 weeks, it was down just to me. So I ended up virtually with private tutoring with Greek, so I had the time to really learn it, to really understand it. So I got the equivalent of 2 years college Greek within the 1 year. Well, all during the time, they said, well, you older pastors, you can choose where you want to go in the church areas, whichever ones are open. And so we get into the second semester, and I knew that San Jose was coming open because I knew that they were going to bring in Wayne Dunlap. So I was a senior pastor among all those that were there. And at that time, Dennis Pyle was one of the assistants in church administration, and he was responsible for placing us. Well, they slated me to go to Minnesota. Well, David has these bronchial problems at that time, catch pneumonia real quickly. He said, well, we can't go there. So they wanted to send me to Texas. And I said, I would have a hard time being accepted in Texas. Well, how about Wheeling, West Virginia? And I thought to myself, you really want to bury me, don't you? So I looked Dennis Pyle right in the eye, and I said, you guys are a bunch of hypocrites, political hypocrites. You tell us one thing, and I know that San Jose is open, and you tell me that I have to go here and there. And I said, yeah, and you want to bury me, don't you, in Wheeling, West Virginia? I said, now I'm going to hold you to your word. Either I get San Jose, or I'm not transferring. I'm going to hold you to your word. Well, he didn't like that. He wasn't these smooth, young, political, get-along, go-along political climbers. Plus, inbred into the family system, you know, the Hammers. Piles and Hammers and so forth. So anyway, I guess that kind of took them back. So what they did, they got a hold of Rick Guype in Monterey. And they said, Rick, we have a promotion for you. We have two churches down here in Southern California that we would like you to pastor. And Monterey was 140 people. So going from almost 800 to 140. So they came and they said, Fred, we can't give you San Jose, but how's Monterey? And I figured, thank you, God. Yes, I will take it. So that's how we got to Monterey. And so we moved up there. That's how we got to Hollister. Well, we sold our house and had $10,000 down to put on another house when we moved up to Monterey. It was actually Hollister, and I would drive over, and we moved out on some acreage. You know, if you're in the city, you like to get in the country. So we bought 2.5 acres. We got a house that had 2 bedrooms. I put an addition on it when we were there. In 2.5 years, we sold it for 92. We bought it for 47, sold it for 92, and built a house in town. Well, right about the time we were ready to build the house in town, the word came down, don't visit the brethren unless they ask you. Hey, I could visit all the heads of house twice a month, hands down, with no problem. Now you're telling me don't visit until they ask. So that's when we built our house. And I did 50% hands-on. I'd get up and I'd be up there at 7 in the morning, work on the house, go visit from 2 until about 8 at night, and so forth. So anyway, if you hear that Fred Coulter lives in a mansion, according to some people's description, we do. It's 4,200 square feet. We bought it ourselves. It's our own money. Didn't use any church money. It cost us $78,000 to build, including the land. We got a 16,000-square-foot lot for $13,000. We've kept it up and improved it through the years. Today, it's worth probably $800,000. But why even sell it? Because it would cost you that much to replace what you have or even more.